And Smashville, good morning, and thank you for joining us. Hour number two of Morning Drive off and running here on this Thursday. ESPN 102.5 The Game, Nick Braden, D-Mace, and Chase. Good hour coming up. We'll go behind enemy lines. Mike DiRocco covers the Jaguars. He'll join us at 7:30. Also, we got a little bit of a sparring contest between head coaches in college football. We'll get to that.
We got beef?
Oh, we got beef.
Media beef.
Media beef.
You
love
like
it.
Beef? You want beef?
But here,
we know you don't.
You don't
like
eat
beef,
man.
Yeah, beef.
Well, you got green beans. You got green beans. You got veggies.
You ever seen?
You ate a lot of green beans, by the way, on Sunday.
Yeah, I did.
You had a big plate of green beans in the Titans press box.
Yeah, they were good.
Popcorn, green beans, and mac
really
and cheese.
Good.
It's an interesting little spread you put together.
Yeah, it was cool. And popcorn.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah. Popcorn. Popcorn.
Yeah. All right, so. Let's get down to business here. This is a big weekend. I've said for a couple of days that I'm really jacked up for the entire weekend of football because you've got so many good matchups both Saturday and Sunday, but it is really a measuring stick weekend for all the teams that we care about here locally. But I want to ask you this question because all three teams that we follow here are underdogs this weekend. The Titans are about a touchdown underdog in Jacksonville. Vanderbilt is about a two-point underdog at home against South Carolina. And the Vols are about a 4.5-point underdog to the Gators. So if I were to ask you which one is more likely to pull the upset this weekend, where are you leaning?
Is it cheating to just say Vanderbilt 1, Tennessee 2, Titans 3 because they are the 3-point spreads in order?
No.
2 points, 4.5 points, 6.5 points. But it does feel like that. I do feel like Vanderbilt has the best chance to win. I think the Vols have a good chance to win as well. And I think they know how important this game is because there is not a lot of opportunity for wins over the next month. I don't see a way that the Tennessee Titans win this game. I can't find a game plan. I trust the coaching staff. Unless the defense is – and Rashawn Evans and Harold Landry and all these young players are fully healthy, Derek Morgan's back. If everybody's fully healthy and 100% and they play an out-of-this-world great defensive game and they win, like, you know, 11-8, you know, like, that's the only way I could see – I think the defense has to win this weekend for the Titans. I think the Vols, it could be Garantano that wins the game. And I think Vanderbilt might just be as good a team completely as – South Carolina from like top to bottom, they might just be as good as South Carolina.
That's why I put Vandy more likely because to me Vandy's the better team. So I wouldn't and I know Vegas has the line. Where is that?
But is Vandy a better team than South Carolina?
Yeah, I think Vandy's a better team than South Carolina.
Definitely a better team than Tennessee.
Yeah, and a better team than Tennessee right now. Yeah, but I just think to me it wouldn't be a big upset. To me, it would be Vandy doing what they're supposed to do at home after playing a hard-fought game against Notre Dame and coming up, you know, short. The biggest win for me, the most likely team to win for me in this scenario, Vandy, but I think they're the better team anyway.
Well, like, here's what worries me about that game.
I mean, we'll find out.
Yeah,
you just laid it all on the line last week at Notre Dame, right? You got up for that game. They played a really good game. Could have won it five different ways. You come back, South Carolina, after a beatdown 2 weeks ago, had a week off because of a weather delay. Is there, when you look at those two situations.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. And we talked to Coach Mason about that yesterday, and he said his team, they were in the right – they were focused. They were in the right mind state. They knew what happened in New Orleans, meaning Notre Dame, and they recognized that they moved on. And he doesn't believe that there will be a letdown.
I think what helps them, too.
Tennessee, on the other hand, with Florida, right. I think
– I don't think anybody has any idea.
Yeah, but I think they have a better shot at winning. And not to say that Vandy doesn't. I just think Vandy's the better team, so I expect them to win. But if you're looking at it like who really supposed to win and who should, like if you're going by the numbers, Vegas, to me I just think it would be UT. I think it would be UT because I expect Vandy to win, so it wouldn't be big to me.
Well,
or
but
out of the norm.
But your answer to the question is Vanderbilt.
Yeah,
I mean that's the answer to the question for you. And I think Tennessee has a good chance to win, but let me float a weird theory about Vanderbilt because we talked a lot about the stadium and we've talked a lot about the atmosphere and the crowd. It's something we talk about with Vanderbilt every single major important home game we've ever talked about with Vanderbilt is Are they going to get a big enough crowd to have an impact? I want to go the other direction on this because I saw this happen last week with Syracuse. Syracuse beat Florida State for the first time since 1966, first time in ACC history. By the way, one of the few picks I got right last week in our picks against the spread, I had the Cuse plus the three. They destroyed Florida State, in part because at 11 a.m., you know, or let's say it was, I guess, Eastern time, it was 12. At noon in Syracuse, the building is sort of two-thirds full, and it's kind of sleepy, and it's kind of this drab atmosphere, and like Syracuse just came out and let their play do the talking, and they sort of punched Florida State in the mouth, and Florida State never recovered. I don't think Vanderbilt's going to win 30-7, but I think this is one of those cases where, because the atmosphere is so sort of sleepy, and isn't it 11? Is it an 11 a.m. or is it 3:30?
Yep. No, I think it's
might
11.
Be 2:30. Either way, if it is 32,000 people, kind of quiet, it might actually help Vanderbilt because South Carolina is used to the 2001 Space Odyssey with 90,000 people screaming their lungs out. They're used to this giant, crazy atmosphere when Georgia came to town. And Vanderbilt, it's sometimes that can take the air out of the other team when you come into
3 o'clock our time.
That may actually hurt Vanderbilt. If it had been an 11 a.m. start time with a half-empty building, can sometimes play in your favor. I know it sounds crazy. I know it's counterintuitive, but it can sometimes play in your favor when the other guy coming in is used to playing at 6 p.m. or 5 p.m. in front of 90,000 people. And that, I think there's an element of this is going to be strictly about football for Vanderbilt. It's not going to be this raucous crowd, raucous environment. And maybe it is, and I'll give Vanderbilt fans credit for that. But I think taking this normal thing that South Carolina is used to experiencing and taking that out of the equation, I think it actually helps Vanderbilt in this situation. So, I think Vanderbilt can be the better team. Tennessee, to me, it's just about Garantano. If Garantano plays well, he is the clear advantage over Felipe Franks, and he could be the reason that the Tennessee Vols win that game.
We got about 60 seconds left, but could you envision a scenario where Dan Mullen yanks Felipe Franks in this game?
100%.
Okay.
100%.
That's what I was thinking.
It will happen at some point. They cannot continue like this. If because both offenses have looked really good in the two bad games they've played. They both looked really questionable in the two legitimate games they played. Kentucky dominated Florida and West Virginia dominated Tennessee. The other two games for both teams don't really apply. We need to see. This is a first kind of, because it's a rivalry, we're going to find out a little bit more about the quarterback for Florida. I think we know everything we need to know about Garantano. He's the guy. We just need to see him go out and continue to progress. I think Franks, there's a chance if he struggles that we just need to be done with him. If I'm a Florida fan, there needs to be, like, listen, we have not seen the growth from year one to year two. We have not seen what we need to see. Let's try Kyle Trask and see what we've got.
Right now, you got to be listening for the cue to call and qualify for a chance to win a trip to Bristol, Connecticut to visit the ESPN headquarters. A grand prize includes a sit-in of a live broadcast of Golic and Wingo, a customized VIP ESPN headquarter experience that includes touring ESPN studios and more. Then on Friday, September 28th, if your name is called during the 5 o'clock hour of Jared and the GM, you will have 10 minutes and 25 seconds to call in and win. More details at thegamenashville.com. So again, this hour, be listening for the cue to call and for your chance to qualify for a trip to ESPN. When we come back, a sparring match between an SEC head coach and Brian Kelly. Stay there. It's Morning Drive right here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back in.
This is on Revenge of the Nerds, wasn't it?
Shout out to Braden.
Oh yeah, cool.
This is on. No, it was on.
It's done a lot of movies.
Yeah.
All right, Derek. Who sings this?
Three Blind Mice.
This is the
Twisted Sister.
There you go.
This is the band of the. This is one of the bands that represents an entire genre that was put out of business by Nirvana. Never mind. Just gonna remind people.
Was Twisted Sister a one hit wonder? Was this all they did? Pretty
that's
much.
It.
No, they had. They had this, and they had I Want to Rock.
I Want to Rock's pretty good.
So two hit wonder.
Yeah.
Well, he made a lot of money off of those two hits.
I mean, the pants and the hair. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that smells like.
Wasn't D. Snyder though kind of involved with like Al Gore and Tipper Gore on the whole parental advisory thing?
Yes, there was a lot of. He had to testify in front of Congress, I believe.
Yeah,
And has been very outspoken about that. So good for him for doing that. He did pave the way for the grunge rock era to show up. But anyway, media beef between coaches.
Beef.
So
how about this? Beef.
We got a little bit of a beef, and I find this interesting because I thought Saturday. Vanderbilt really came to fight against Notre Dame. Derek Mason, we had him on yesterday. I mean, he was digging into referees. I mean, he was fired up throughout that whole game on Saturday. And now we've got a verbal sparring match between Brian Kelly at Notre Dame, Derek Mason at Vanderbilt. Let's set up the audio. First of all, here is Fighting Irish head coach Brian Kelly.
I mean, he was getting cut maliciously by their defensive end. I mean, it's bad football.
Is that legal?
It's legal, but it's bad football. It's just bad football, and I have no problem saying it. You know, we're so concerned about, you know, frontal cuts, and we got a defensive end, you know, chopping him on every play, and he hung in there every play.
So Brian Kelly not happy about the way some of the Vanderbilt players were going about that game.
He needs to shut up. Just shut up. The guy asked him the most important question.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a legal play? Yeah. Okay, then.
So legal, but...
Legal, but...
Dirty?
It wasn't dirty. I mean, what's dirty about
more,
it?
It's
we're
prayer.
No, we're playing a game of football, and you're asking me to do... You're asking me to do everything within the rules, and I'm doing everything within the rules. And just because... You don't like it doesn't mean it's a dirty play. I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. It's just this is a strategy. You know, some defensive, you know, coordinators or whatnot they employ.
Well, Braden, set up the action. Try to explain it visually.
Yeah, a couple of the plays are the tight end is on the like. So a lot of times you have a tight end set up in the backfield, sort of behind a tackle. When the tight end motions after the snap, the tight end sort of. Cuts across the face of the quarterback to the backside and is either going out for a pass pattern or is trying to kick out block on a run play. And what Derek Mason planned and clearly was the strategy on this is that when they saw that motion from the tight end coming across the formation like that after the snap of the ball, sort of behind the line of scrimmage, I mean, that they told he clearly told his defensive ends to go at the thighs and the knees of the line of the tight end, take him out. So that way, A, he's not getting into his pass pattern. Or B, you've clogged up the potential running lane. So that was clearly the strategy. It's not exactly a clean football play, but it's not a dirty football play either. And that's why it's legal. Now, they were more vicious. I think, and I can't remember who the defensive end is for Vanderbilt that was doing this, but he was doing a really good job of it. So he was knifing the dude down. I mean, he was chopping him out pretty hard. And so I understand Brian Kelly saying, you know, that's not really... it's not illegal football. It's not bad football. What then Brian Kelly needs to do is when he sees that, make adjustments.
Exactly. That's Kelly's
fault. That's what Brian Kelly needs to do. And obviously we'll hear from Derek Mason, his response to all of this, because that's obviously more important.
I mean, nowadays when we talk about, you know, playing football, you know, I really don't care much about Brian Kelly's comments about football. Because when you go back and watch that game from the holding to the post chops, by Notre Dame, I thought it was bad football on their part, okay? But what it comes down to is that the game gets played on the football field. Nowadays, okay, I mean, we're asking defensive players to raise the target, lower the target, you know, I mean, hit with their eyes up. I mean, all these things are really a part of football. So with Brian Kelly can take his comments and keep it moving. And if he's got something personal with me, man, he can come see me.
There you have it.
I love it. I love it from D-Mates. Let me ask you, Derek. Mm-hmm. Your wide receiver, let's say on every off-tackle play to your side with Eddie George, every single time the defensive back reads that, that he dives at your knees. Because you're trying to block him, right? Mm-hmm. Like, handoff, Steve hands off to Eddie. It's an off-tackle behind Brad Hopkins off the right side or whatever. You're outside the box.
Well, it's never happened.
It's illegal then.
Yeah, it's illegal.
Let's say
it's
you're in
never
the,
happened.
Let's say you motion into the slot, right? Let's say, because a lot of times you'll see, now what the NFL is doing in college is you'll see receivers motion into the into the line and be part of the blocking, you know, scheme to kick out or whatever. If the read from the defensive back is, I'm seeing Eddie George coming my direction, I'm reading that off-tackle play towards my side, And I've been told as a coach to go cut the receiver that's blocking me, mm-hmm. to clog up the running lane, or maybe to stop a play action pass. How do you feel about that if you're a tight end, let's say, mm-hmm. and you're in the box?
Well, the first time I'm mad, but then the second time, I'm not going to let it happen again after it happened the first time. The first time, okay, you got me, I'm upset, don't do that. But then I'm not going to let it happen again. So tight end is your fault. Brian Kelly, you knew that they were doing this. Make adjustments. Do something else. Tell your guy to go low. Do something so you don't put your guy in a position where he is getting cut. Because whether it's – now, if the guy was coming high and holding the guy and they never called, Brian Kelly, oh, he held our guy every time. Right. You know, he should find another way to block him. Yeah. Well, they did.
And I'll say this. Coach Derek Mason is right as well about how physical Notre Dame was being when it comes to the holding and the post – play chops and stuff. I here's the deal. This was a physical football game.
It was
a good football game, and as a result of that, we've got two coaches fired up about stuff, and I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with both guys being angry to protect their teams. I'm not even really sure which side I'm on. I think I'm on Derek Mason's side on this, because it's his job, it's Brian Kelly's job to adjust and make an adjustment. If it's a legal play, Derek Mason needs to do everything he can to try to win a game. So if it's a legal play and it's not too, like, there's dirty and then there's like dirty, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's like, oh, this is a little bit rough around the edges. And then there's like, you're a dirty player. And I don't think anything reaches that level. So I'm on Derek Mason's side on this, but I think it was a really physical football game. It was a good football game. I think whoever watched that game is who won the game, right? Like fans mm-hmm. won that game because mm-hmm. it was a great game to watch.
Any surprise that Brian Kelly will be complaining about this publicly following the win?
I don't know what Brian Kelly gets out of this.
Because really you can don't. Take your complaints to the officiating crew the league, right?
But he never had it's not a complaint.
Well, he was wearing the officials out. That's what he was asked about. Uh-huh. So and somebody in the press conference said, hey, you were wearing the officials out during the game. What, you know, why? Basically, he was asked about something, and he responded with, I didn't like what Derek Mason's Vanderbilt Commodores were doing to my tight ends, is what he responded with.
Again, if the ref told you that it was a legal play, this is part of the game. It's legal,
yep.
Brian. I can't do it. There's no need to keep coming back at the – are they going to now change the rules midstream? Hey, Coach Mason, that's a penalty now. Just for this game, for this moment, because Brian Kelly's – he's chewing me out over here. I'm going to make it a penalty. No, they're not. I could see if it was some egregious play and they just kept missing it. Yeah, he has a gripe. You know, he can fuss all he wants to. But it was a legal play. So – man, just
so let me ask
pick up your football and go home.
Let me ask you this though.
Kick rocks.
What other plays? Because I think a lot of people that have watched the film on these couple of plays that people have put out on the internet have said he called it bad football. He didn't call mm-hmm. it dirty. He said bad football. Are there other situations and other plays that you can think of that are legal but bad football? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Nope. NFL basically. Well. I'm saying the NFL.
You know what came to my mind, though, when you brought these up? Like, bad football versus illegal, dirty stuff? Mm-hmm. Hines Ward as opposed to Ndamukong Suh. Like, Ndamukong Suh was flat out a dirty player.
Well, he was stepping on people. Right. That's not even a part of the rules. That's not a part of the rules.
Right.
He got fined, he got kicked, whatever. That's what happened to Ndamukong Suh. But what Hines was doing at the time was legal.
Yeah.
And people knew it was coming, so they kept their head on a swivel. Now it's not legal.
Here's the one thing. I think it is a controversial play, but it's not fair to Derek Mason's defense on this situation, because if the tight end makes that cut block and
exactly.
dives at the defensive end's knees, we're all going to say great block.
Exactly.
We're all going to say great block. So I will acknowledge that Brian Kelly may be onto something and that it's a controversial play, but what's good for the goose in this case, the offense, needs mm-hmm. to be good for the gander, which is the defense. And so if we're going to say that you're allowed to dive at a player's knees to block him, mm-hmm. then the defensive player has to have the same right
exactly.
to dive at the offensive player who's coming to either block him or go out on a pass route. So I think there needs to be consistency. So either they need to all be illegal or Brian Kelly needs to get over it.
Brian Kelly, shush. You won the game. It was a hard-fought game by both teams. It was a really good game. Both teams, just let it go.
Do you think they both should be illegal, or do you think it's fine the way it is?
If you make one illegal, they both should be illegal.
Okay.
You know.
All right, coming up next, what is the status of Leonard Fournette for Sunday? Are the Jaguars thinking Super Bowl? Mike DiRocco of ESPN NFL Nation covers the Jaguars. He'll join us next as we go behind enemy lines here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 A Game. Congratulations to Brian Wood. He is our qualifier this morning for the chance to go to Bristol, Connecticut to tour the ESPN headquarters. And the correct answer was Chris Berman. So congratulations, Brian Wood. As we get ready for the Titans and Jaguars on Sunday, we welcome in Mike DiRocco of ESPN NFL Nation, covers the Jacksonville Jaguars as we go behind enemy lines here on a Thursday. Mike, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, guys. How are you guys today?
Doing well. Mike, I saw a stat yesterday that Blake Bortles is 4-0 and the Jaguars score 30-plus a game in the absence of Leonard Fournette. I found that to be very surprising. Does that come off as a surprise to you?
Oh, absolutely. I actually had our ESPN stats group take a deep look at that too, and you know, I think it's his touchdown interception ratio is 17-14 with Fournette, 9-1 without him. I mean, it's unbelievable. I think it's a little bit of a statistical anomaly, but Bortles did admit yesterday that, hey, look, when Leonard's not in there, throwing the ball is much bigger part of the game plan. So I think that opens the offense up a little bit, makes it a little bit more a little harder to defend. But that doesn't mean by any stretch of the imagination that over the long haul, they're a better team without Fournette. I think that that's not what that shows, though.
How long did you see the Jalen Ramsey personification development take place in real time? I mean, we obviously know him here in high school in Nashville, but did you notice this? Have you sort of watched it progress? And how long have you known that this guy could sort of explode into this big personality that he is today?
Well, we saw a little bit of it his rookie year when he went at it with Steve Smith after the game and was ripping Steve Smith. And, you know, that was sort of a little bit of a whoa. I mean, this is a young kid, and, yeah, he's got a ton of talent, and we think he's going to be really, really good, but that's Steve Smith. And, you know, I would kind of think twice about messing with that guy. But, you know, it's sort of – he's always had that confidence. I think you guys know he's always been a real confident guy. Just hasn't been as vocal. But as the team became more successful last year, I think it brought him out of his shell. Because if you remember his rookie year and, you know, he was on the sideline crying at the end of that Lions game because he just – you know, the cameras caught him crying and saying, I'm just so tired of losing. And I think once they started winning, it really kind of helped this team. Or helped him become the person, the vocal, even more vocal guy that he is now.
Yeah, because this is a guy that wasn't used to losing. I mean, he won in high school, he won in college, and then he gets to the Jacksonville Jaguars, and all of a sudden, you know, he's experiencing something that he hasn't experienced before. But now, like you said, this team has put everything together, and if not the best team in the NFL, they are definitely the second best. Looking at, because I think a lot of this, when you're talking to Jacksonville Jaguars, I think a lot of this, some of it, you know, bulk of it, yeah, is the defense. But I think a lot of it is what Blake Bortles has been able to do the last year and a half close to 2 years now with this team. Ever since, you know, they've gotten Tom Coughlin, Doug Marrone was named the head coach, it seems that Blake Bortles has bought into whatever they're preaching there in Jacksonville now, whereas under the last regime, he didn't buy – either he didn't buy into it or they were putting too much on him at such an early time in his career. Has it seemed to you that he's truly bought into – you know, what Tom Coughlin has brought in and what Doug Marrone has brought in as far as from a schematic standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is his personality, too, is sort of he doesn't care about, you know, the accolades. He doesn't care about the criticism. All he wants to do is win, and he's fine with, you know, if that means this week against the Titans turning around and handing it off 47 times, he's completely fine with that. And if it means next week against the Jets throwing it 57 times, he's fine. He just wants to win. He'll do whatever. He just doesn't care about the stats or the accolades or anything. And I think that's partly because of what he went through and what everyone else went through from, you know, 14, 15, 16, how terrible it was here. But I do think that Nathaniel Hackett, the offensive coordinator, deserves a lot of credit as well because, you know, we had Jed Fish his first year, Greg Olsen his year and a half,
And now he's finally got the stability with Nathaniel Hackett. This is his second full season going into with Hackett running the offense. They really have a good relationship. Hackett is a smart guy, understands what Blake really does, has a really good understanding of what Blake does well, what Blake doesn't like, what Blake doesn't do well. And they've really tailored that passing game to kind of fit him a little bit. And I think as he's gained confidence, you know, that obviously helps you play better. Anytime you're playing with more confidence, you're going to play better. So I think all of that comes together. And look, the winning helps. When you're winning, everything feels good. So even if you only throw seven passes in a game, you won the game, that feels good. Because they all remember Bortles, Ramsey, Telvin Smith, all those guys remember what it was like to not win. And not only to not win, to get your teeth kicked in every week. So I think all that together has sort of kind of helped Blake make the growth over the last year and a half to where he's not making those mistakes. He's not turning the ball over as much. He's not putting the team in bad situations.
How much credit from a 10,000-foot view of this turnaround for Jacksonville goes to Doug Marrone, and how much goes to Tom Coughlin?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because last year everybody always said, hey, the Coughlin's here, and that's the reason for the turnaround. And I was always a little bit cautious. I was, you know, like, hey, some of this stuff belongs on Doug Marrone's shoulders. And for Marrone, having Coughlin there is a huge advantage. They get along. They both are the same philosophically. He's got a mentor. He's got a guy he can turn to for advice, not only about schemes, but, you know, how to handle a situation with a team, how to run a team, that kind of stuff. But, you know, a lot of the things that people gave Coughlin credit for were actually Doug Marrone's things. You know, rearranging the locker room so it wasn't position groups anymore. That was Marrone. Taking the ping pong table out of the locker room. That was Doug Marrone, not Tom Coughlin. Everyone thought that was Coughlin, but it was Marrone. So he, to me, Coughlin is a little bit more in the background than people outside may think. So Marrone deserves a lot of the credit, and he's done a very good job on game day. I think with the exception of that AFC championship game, where I think that they got too conservative at the end of the first half, too conservative in the second half, I think that they've done a really good job on game day being aggressive and coaching this team and giving them chances to win, putting them in a chance to win. And Marrone deserves as much or more credit than Coughlin does, in my opinion.
Mike, final question for me. When here in Nashville, we're dealing with injuries to our tackles and Taylor Lewan and Jack Conklin. The Jaguars were dealt a blow this past week as you lost Cam Robinson, starting left tackle out of Alabama. How do the Jaguars fill that void, and do they change any of their scheme and their philosophy offensively losing that guy at left tackle?
Yeah, it's going to be Josh Wells, who's a fourth-year player, an undrafted guy that they've had on the roster for a while. Yeah, they're going to have to give him some help. They're going to have to chip with the backs. They're going to have to put a tight end over there every once in a while, maybe a little bit more than normal. You know, he played okay last week. There were some plays where he was beat badly, but there were some other plays where he more than held his own. And he really struggled in the preseason, but seems to have settled down. Clearly not the same level of Cam Robinson, although Robinson was not playing at an extremely high level. You know, so far this year, but that's going to be an issue for them going forward. They're going to have to give him some help, and you know, especially against better pass rushers, you know, like what we're going to see this weekend.
Mike, good stuff. We appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Derek, I did want to say something really quick. If you're still there, I was writing a story about the Jaguars and the Titans rivalry, and I was going back over that '99 AFC Championship game, and I forgot that you had returned that kick for a touchdown after the safety. That was a real turning point in that game. I completely forgot about that. So I'm glad I got a chance to, you know, chat with you today. Just to, you know, I just saw that yesterday when I was doing the research.
Derek, give him a comment. Give him a comment on the record here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm glad you remember, because the Titans don't. the organization here don't now, but wow. I'm glad you do and acknowledges it. I really do appreciate it. No, that was, and you know, funny part about it is that I was just watching it because somebody sent it to me, like just the whole game, but they sent it in like a 10-minute, you know, clip, but the whole game and how that game went kind of back and forth. I didn't realize that we had as many turnovers as we got as many turnovers as we did against that Jacksonville team. We had like four or five turnovers somewhere around there. And I didn't even realize that, but that was a hard fought game until, we got the safety by Josh Evans, and then they kick the ball off the free kick, and I end up returning it for a touchdown. That kind of, both of those plays kind of broke open the game.
3-0
Yeah.
As a team.
Yeah, beat them all three times, and then Jeff Fisher the next week made the comment about it felt sort of like their second home stadium, and Jaguar fans hate them ever since. It's unbelievable how much they and you'd think they would hate you, but Fisher let you off the hook.
Yeah, it did.
Well, and there's some Titans fans that don't like Jeff Fisher all that much right now.
Good stuff, Mike. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yep. You got it. So somebody sent you highlights, and you were watching that.
Yeah.
You
said I was watching the AFC Championship game with the Jags. I thought you were talking about last year with the Patriots.
No.
I didn't know you were watching 99.
Yeah, 99. Because somebody sent it to me, and they sent it like in a just like a 10-minute little clip, but it connected all the highlight plays of both teams.
How often do you watch highlights of yourself?
Not much. Honestly, I really don't.
Really?
Yeah.
Because if I was
I really don't.
I'm telling you.
I don't know if I completely believe that.
I watch it every day.
No, I don't.
But is
it
narcissistic to do that, or is it just like reliving your glory? Like, is it? I don't know. I feel like it's not that narcissistic, actually.
To have the career he had is like it was winning Powerball. I'd watch that thing every stinking day.
I will tell you the funniest moment that I have ever had with Derek Mason. It was 3D. We were at the arena, and Darren and Willie came up with the topic of what is one game that just you have not watched since it happened because it just was too painful for you that you would go back and watch. Well, he brings up the 2000.
No, Willie did. No. Darren brought it up.
Okay,
well,
Darren
you go
brings
back
up
and
the,
watch that.
The go back and watch the 2000 game against the Ravens in the playoffs. Well, he brings it up during the show, and you just hear the. What is he doing?
Yeah,
ow!
I was there for that game too.
I was in tears. I was laughing so hard.
Darren, I could see Ray Lewis.
That's probably the worst. Thing you suggested since we've been friends.
Now you were on the
for therapeutic reasons to go watch that game. Seriously,
but no, you were on the field for the Ray Lewis. Were you on the field?
Yeah,
for the
I was
Ray
on
Lewis
the field.
Could you see it from where you were?
Yeah.
Were you on the other side of the field?
No, I saw it. It was there. You could see it on the screen.
That is something I like as a visual memory of like where it happened on the field. Like on the wasn't it like on the 20-yard line? It was like
it was
the return
it was
wasn't
like
that
a
30 long,
30
right?
or 40-yard return somewhere around there.
I just remember Ray Lewis scooping it and just being like,
then a field goal kicker missed. All right, let's go to break.
Coming up next, why one college program can learn about accountability from an NBA franchise. That's next here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're bringing you Nashville's best college football preview show each and every Saturday at Saturday Tailgate. Join myself and Julian Council every Saturday, 9 to 11, here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, brought to you by Mafiosa's Pizzeria and Neighborhood Pub. All right, Joe Rexroad, top of the hour, but we've talked about accountability in college football, in college athletics. Maryland getting things right, Ohio State not taking accountability, and one of the biggest stories right now today in the world of sports nationally, it's been all over ESPN this morning, and we got to give it a couple of minutes here on this show, is the story about the accountability with the Dallas Mavericks and Mark Cuban.
Yeah, first of all, go watch the interview that Rachel Nichols did with Mark Cuban. Needless to say, there was not a single talk about from Rachel Nichols. A great interview from Rachel Nichols. If you want to learn, if you're a young broadcaster and you want to learn about how to ask good questions in a very tough setting about a tough subject, go watch the interview. It's also just a really good interview in general. Mark Cuban, I think, I don't know if he should be punished more or less. I don't know if there's legal implications in him running an organization that sort of had 20 years worth of sort of not enforcing their rules and making it a safe workplace for women. But what I find interesting is how he handled the press, his, for lack of a better term, press conference yesterday, how he handled the interview, which was number one thing he did first and foremost was apologize to all the women in the organization. Number two, he accepted responsibility and blamed him and took blame. Said, listen, this is on me. This is my fault. I need to be better. I missed it. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. And it just rings in such stark contrast to what Ohio State did for me. I don't know if there's any legal – like, I don't think Urban Meyer did anything wrong legally. I don't know if Mark Cuban did anything wrong legally. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I can't tell you. But I know from a PR standpoint, the way you handle this stuff matters to people. And should Mark Cuban be punished more? You know, we can all have our own opinion on that. But when you come out and you say, listen, I am sorry, I did this wrong, I need to be better, and then donate $10 million, it starts the wheels of correcting the mistake. I'm not saying he shouldn't be punished or that he didn't do a bunch of wrong things, but it's the right way to do this part of the process, which is to start the healing or whatever we're talking about here. I mean, it just rings. So you listen to Urban Meyer talk and you're just like, dude, like what?
Tone deaf.
Yeah, it's just so different. I'm not saying Mark Cuban is right or like is a good guy or whatever. It's how you handle this stuff.
From what you hear from people, Mark Cuban is a good guy. He's a stand-up guy. He wants to do the right thing no matter what. And he wants to run, you know, a good, you know, business. What I liked that he did was take responsibility for it. Because what happens is when you are an owner of several different companies, you're a billionaire, you try to hire people that you think, if I'm not there, if I never come into office, it's going to run. It's going to run the way I want it to run. So you hire people with that in mind. And he thought he hired a guy. Now, from a business standpoint, it probably did run the way it was supposed to. But from a personal standpoint, it wasn't, because he was conducting himself in such a way that was wrong to women. And Mark Cuban stood up, because this is what we talk about all the time. Just admit you're wrong, you know, make amends and move on.
And then prove to us that with things your are actions changing. Yeah. That you've changed.
So, okay, Mark Cuban admitted that it was wrong. He took full responsibility for it, fired a guy, hired someone that is considered the best at, you know, putting a company back together after situations like this. He's hired the best female. I believe she's a female. Like, he's hired her.
You know, equal, yeah. Fair, safe workplace.
Exactly. So he's hired that person. And he said, you know what? I'm going to donate $10 million to women causes. So he's done everything that if we just first saw it, we would want him to do. Here's the thing. Here's the problem. This is why some people are upset. Because the NBA didn't do it. Because the NBA didn't fine him $10 million. I think that's why people are upset. Oh, he only got fined $10 million. The NBA should do something else. Okay, what if he just took responsibility and didn't do anything? Well, took responsibility for it, hired someone else, tried to get his place in order, but didn't donate the money. And the NBA said, we're going to fine you $10 million. Yeah. Everybody would have been like, great, they fined him $10 million.
And we would lose our minds over the amount of money.
Exactly.
We would say, oh, my God, a $10 million fine is like the biggest fine in
history.
But
he was proactive. He said, no, I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to do the right thing. So why punish him for doing the right thing? That's what I don't get. Rachel Nichols was like, you know, he did. This is what we want. He did. He stood up like a man and accepted responsibility. And then he put action to it.
I think what people have a tough time with, and one of the victims, this is a quote from one of the victims who worked there. She worked there from 2010 to 2014. Quote, I think it is wonderful that Mark Cuban is donating this money, but Mark and the culture he created has destroyed so many careers, and he's glib to that fact. He's put profits over people for 18 years. And I don't know what we as a culture or as a group of people are what are we supposed to do with Mark Cuban? Should you take away ownership of a franchise because of this? Maybe he did do something so wrong in creating culture or allowing a CEO who clearly has had some issues or allowing a high-ranking official who may or may not be allegedly doing something to his girlfriend, which is very similar to the Urban Meyer situation where he allowed someone to stay on staff. And Mark Cuban's like it's really weird because I haven't had a chance to read through the entire investigation. It's a lot of documents, but there are lots of documents, and Rachel Nichols said this in the interview. There's tons of evidence to suggest that Mark Cuban didn't know a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of emails and texts. But there's also some evidence that he knew about some of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's really hard to get your head around how much punishment should be implemented here. And I, obviously fixing the workplace is easy, step number one. Helping money to the cause is a huge number two. Accepting responsibility, apologizing to people. Like, all this stuff is the right stuff to do. But I don't have a problem if somebody's saying that's not enough. there needs to be more, especially if you were one of the women that worked there and was treated like this. So I don't know what the answer is.
The way we cover it as a media, when it happens on a college campus as opposed to a professional sports team, like I don't feel like this, from an NBA standpoint, is getting the, and I know it's getting covered a lot today, but compare it to like if this would happen at a college program in the middle of nowhere, don't you think there'd be a different feel and a dynamic to the way it's presented?
That's a great question. If this was, I mean, we covered the Louisville basketball scandal pretty heavily, and that was sort of, I don't know, it's hard to find like an apples
to apples.
Just
feels like college scandals seem more salacious because than when it happens
people.
In the pros.
It's young people.
You have, it's because you have access to tens of thousands of young people, and I think, frankly, let's be very clear about something. If there's sexual harassment, there's domestic abuse, there's rape. There's lots of different varying degrees of bad behavior here. The workplace sexual assaults are probably, again, I'm just guessing here, sexual assault on campuses are far more prevalent, and that like Baylor situation. You know what I mean? Like it's far more prevalent in those situations in college campuses than I would suggest it taking place in the workplace.
Well,
at least that's what I'm hopeful of.
You hope it's that way, but I mean, sexual harassment is defined totally different, because if you ask somebody out a few times and they say no, and or they can consider that you're harassing me.
Harassing
me is uncomfortable.
Putting someone in some girl's drink at a bar in college,
that is just
it's
that crosses all boundaries and lines and everything else. I just don't know what. Now, if the certain individuals now, after what the NBA, what Mark Cuban has done, if they now want to file a suit against his company, they can do that.
I would assume that's coming.
Yeah, they can do that, and then that's, okay, something else that goes on top of him already donating, $10 million or whatnot, and that's probably coming, and rightfully so.
It'll be fascinating to watch how it plays out, because I don't think anybody has the right answer yet on what the right thing to do is, and I think we're all sort of working through it together, trying to figure out what's right here.
Coming up next, we will get back to the Tennessee Titans. How does this team pull off the big upset this weekend in Jacksonville? Joe Rexroad from the Tennessean is going to join us. We'll talk to him next here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game, and streaming on the Game Nashville app.